You're listening to FMGRadio.com. Welcome to Generation Reinvention, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Future, with your host, Brent Green.
Welcome back. Starting a new year with about 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 a day for the next 19 years. That's going to change the future, and that's what we're here to talk about. You know, I have a friend by the name of Jim, and he was vice president and general manager of a CBS affiliate for nearly 20 years. When he ascended to this level of responsibility, ironically, he became the youngest general manager of a TV station in the nation. Today, after years of study, he is a licensed hypnotherapist and owns a clinic dedicated to helping people rid themselves of addictions, most notably cigarettes. And for those boomers who have been smoking for 20, 30, 40, even 50 years, quitting cigarettes is of utmost necessity. So he's entered a good field at the right time. My friend Don worked for 18 years as a broadcast industry executive. In her last corporate job, she served as a CFO for a group of AM and FM radio stations. Now she is a director of education for a public speaking organization. Instead of managing complex financial problems daily, she is helping others become proficient at public speaking. As more boomers choose to reinvent themselves to become entrepreneurs and knowledge consultants, many seek public communication training as a core skill. My friend David spent almost 30 years in the publishing industry. In addition to publishing several trade magazines during his career, he also served as vice president of a major consumer lifestyle magazine, where he was responsible for $54 million in annual revenue. Today, he owns a healthcare agency providing in-home non-medical services to elderly and disabled clients. He is taking advantage of a rapidly aging population by creating a business to serve future healthcare needs of boomers, a generation expressing strong preferences for home care over assisted living and nursing homes. Now, what do these three people have in common? All three were formerly top executives, but are now anticipating major changes in a generation of which they are also members. Like them, many boomers are at some stage of reinvention, ergo the title of this show. My friends also personify a major action type as described in research conducted by the Institute for the Future. We are joined today by Richard Adler, the architect and leader of this important research study. A little background. 30 years ago, he was appointed to a position at the Aspen Institute Program on Communications and Society, where he considered the potential of pay television to change the economics of TV programming, anticipating subscription networks like HBO that emerged a few years later. So he was ahead of the curve. He was also supported by the National Science Foundation to assess the effects of advertising on children a few years before that became a very important topic. He later wrote scripts for a PBS series on economics and ended up as the television critic for the Wall Street Journal. In the early 1980s, when new digital media were emerging, Richard joined the Institute for the Future, a nonprofit think tank in Silicon Valley, where he focused on the emergence of online services. In the mid-1980s, at a time when these services were being used by less than 1% of Americans, he was asked to provide a vision for the state of the technology in the year 2000. He predicted correctly that by 2000, half of all Americans would be online. Most recently, he has focused on understanding the future of fields such as aging, healthcare, and education, and has continued to work with both the Aspen Institute and the Institute for the Future. So I'd like you to welcome Richard Adler. How are you today, Richard?
I'm just fine, and I'm really happy to be with you, Brent.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I very much appreciate it. You know, one of the things that I've always been fascinated about in your background, Richard, is that you spent a few halcyon years in Aspen, Colorado. So can you tell us a little bit about what you were doing in Aspen when you were there with the Aspen Institute and what some of the challenging projects that you were involved in?
Sure. In the early 1970s, I had finished my graduate work, which had been in English literature, and I'd gone off to the Midwest to teach English at Oberlin College, which is a fine institution in Ohio. But after a year or two there, I came to the conclusion that teaching English literature was not my life's calling, and that I wanted to do something a little more contemporary. As I was thinking about that, I also got interested in what at the time was being called new media, and there was a revolution underway today this all seems incredibly ancient and primitive, but a gadget was created by Sony called the Portapack, which was the first portable video recorder. I mean, it was a big box that you had to sling over your shoulder on a strap, and then you had a camera that was, you know, the size of a bread box. But it was the first time that individuals could get their hands on television production equipment, and it was viewed as a somewhat revolutionary technology in that era. And the other thing that was happening is that in many little cities and large cities around the country, where television essentially meant broadcast, which meant three networks and a public broadcasting system, cable systems were arriving, which were offering what was called the television of abundance. Suddenly, instead of three or four channels, now there was the possibility of 100 channels, which just seemed mind-boggling. And I got interested in this, and it occurred to me that rather than studying literature, which was a sort of a pretty mature medium, here you could be witnessing the birth of a brand new medium. Uh-huh. And I wanted to do something about that, and ended up coming back to California, where I'd been a graduate student, and got involved with a program, a brand new program of the Aspen Institute. The Institute itself was several decades old, but in 1972, a man named Douglas Cater, who had just come out of Lyndon Johnson's White House, was at Stanford and had founded something called the Aspen Institute Program on Communications and Society. And it just seemed like the perfect place. And he turned out he needed somebody with my credentials. So I suddenly found myself, instead of teaching in the snowy Midwest, teaching poetry, I was now spending my winters in California next to Stanford. And my summers, we would pick up and we would move to Aspen and hold a series of conferences on things like the future of public broadcasting, the effects of television violence on behavior, and then my particular area was what we call the humanistic claim on the cable, where we were looking at the potential of cable television for sort of changing the nature of what came across the box.
Did you find yourself associating with some of the pioneers of cable, such as Ted Turner or Bill Daniels out of Denver? Were some of those prominent luminaries from the early days of cable involved in some of your activities there?
Yeah, there were. There were a number of people who were pioneers in television, both in cable, but also people like Fred Friendly, who was famous for being Edward R. Murrow's close associate. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the guy who was funding a lot of these efforts and kind of goading us to think about the potential of television.
So suddenly you found yourself in Aspen, Colorado, a place that a lot of people come to think about the future, I guess, or to think about the present on the slopes. But it certainly is a hotbed of innovation and has been for many years. What was it like to work for the Institute? What kind of things did you discover?
The thing that was exciting about bringing people to Aspen was often you were bringing people together who in their day-to-day lives might have been adversaries, the broadcasters and cable executives or regulators and businesses. And the theory was, and it sometimes worked in practice, is that when we would bring them up to the mountaintop, to Colorado, get them away from their day-to-day jobs, and put them in a context. The Aspen Institute, the full name for the Aspen Institute was the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies. And it was the intellectual founder was actually a man named Mortimer Adler, no relation to me, but he came out of the University of Chicago and had pioneered the study of great books. And so the idea of these policy programs on communications was to think about these practical issues like, you know, what kind of television we should have in the context of sort of enduring values of things like democracy or culture and so forth. And it was really interesting. So the discussions had a very distinctive characteristic to them, and I think added a kind of a new note to the discussions of the time. It was also true that in those days, I mean, this is not true any longer, but back then, this was actually nearly 40 years ago in the early 1970s, nobody was real. Very few people were paying serious attention to communications. There were only, as far as I know, two or three schools of communications that would study things like broadcast media, like television, in a serious way. Now it's much more common, and so the Institute was really a kind of a pioneer in trying to think seriously about the significance, the impact of these media on our lives. And its potential for social benefit.
Obviously, this covered a number of years and many, many different initiatives. Can you think of some things that just come to mind where big ahas happened, big insights, ideas that in effect became the future while you were in that environment?
Yeah, well, you already alluded to one, and that was right. I think the very first project I worked on was one that we called the electronic box office, and it was the idea that cultural institutions, think about opera companies or symphony orchestras, typically, you know, depend on two sources of income. One is the income from tickets of people who come to these concerts, but those don't pay all of the costs. And that almost every one of these large cultural institutions depend on essentially begging for financial contributions from donors. And we had this kind of zany idea back in these early days that there might be a third stream of revenue of earned income by taking these cultural events and putting them on pay television so that Metropolitan Opera broadcasts might be enjoyed not just by the people who would go sit at for a live mm-hmm. performance, but could sure. be carried all over the world. And interestingly enough, it didn't really happen on television, but as you may know, on many Saturdays there are live, high-definition digital live broadcasts that are transmitted to theaters all across the country, and it is in fact an electronic box office.
So, anticipating that, obviously, you had a large opportunity to be a part of what would be the burgeoning cable industry, and then perhaps in anticipating the internet. Just to connect this to the future, I know that you were at the Aspen Institute just about a year ago. I hope I don't butcher this function that you had, but I think it's reportier. Is that right?
Rapporteur.
Rapporteur. All right. Yeah. So tell me what that involved, because that you're still involved with the Aspen Institute, and we're involved in a very contemporary project that obviously has implications for the future.
Yeah, it's a great job. In fact, I think I may be the oldest living person or the person with the longest association with the Institute. When I go to these meetings, I see very few people who I can remember being around when I started in the early 70s. The last one I remember was at a meeting 2 years ago where Daniel Shore attended, that wonderful reporter mm-hmm. who was still on actively acting as a commentator on NPR till his death at the age of 91, about a year ago or less. And Dan and I met at a meeting 2 years ago. It's his last visit to Aspen, and he was in fact one of the people who was a regular back in the 1970s.
Well, what was the purpose of the conference?
Oh, this year. I lost the thread. Yeah, so this year, so my job now is I will attend these conferences that are invitation only, typically around a particular topic. These are still programs of the Program on Communications and Society, which is now headed by a guy named Charlie Firestone and based in year-round in Washington, D.C., and then operating in Aspen in the summer. And the conference that that I'm actually just finishing the report on now was called News Cities, and it was grappling with the impact of the rise of digital media on print newspapers, which are more than just businesses. They've historically, newspapers have been the voice of conscience and the glue that holds many metropolitan areas together. And the question is, as newspapers are weakened and possibly disappear, as one of the two major newspapers in your hometown did a year or two ago, the Rocky Mountain News, simply no longer exists. And so now Denver is a one-paper city instead of a two-paper city. And the question is whether local, you know, digital media with citizen journalists will be able to pick up slack, and what has, you know, what is being lost, and what can be done to ensure that cities still get the kind of coverage that citizens need, that communities need to remain healthy democracies.
And obviously, that could be an entirely new line of discussion that we could entertain. Unfortunately, we have so much to cover today, but I, you know, just like to emphasize that you are still connecting with the Aspen Institute. You are involved as the in the role that you serve. You not only witness these amazing discussions between thought leaders throughout the world, but it is your job to synthesize and bring it together, and then, as you described, create a report. So it's not just taking information, it's analysis and interpretation and synthesis. Is that a correct summary?
It is correct. And by the way, one of the nice things about these Aspen reports is that they are all, every one of them, are available for free on the Aspen Institute website and can be downloaded and read by anybody who is interested in these topics.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to move into an area that will be a very specific interest to many in our listening audience, and that is about the future and your role with the Institute for the Future. So we'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back. This is Brent Green. Today, our guest is Richard Adler, who has had an amazing career. It tends to be tied together because Richard has been involved in thinking about, writing about, speaking about, and in some ways affecting the future. One of his major additional alliances over these many years, first as an employer and now as a client, is the Institute for the Future. So, Richard, could you tell us a little bit about, in general, what the Institute for the Future is?
Yes, sure. The Institute is was founded in 1968. It was a spinoff from the RAND Corporation, which is based in Santa Monica. But the Institute, after a short stay in Connecticut, ended up in San Francisco Bay Area. And it's essentially was founded by four researchers who were interested in how do you go about thinking about the future in a systematic and useful way. And so they were people who had developed certain techniques for gathering expert opinion to make forecasts. And the Institute has continued since 1968, so now more than 40, I don't know, except maybe now 50 years, as a think tank based now in Palo Alto, California, that works for government, for foundations, and for corporations helping them sort of integrate a futures perspective in their planning.
Throughout our discussion, I'll be mentioning the Institute for the Future. I might use shorthand, an acronym, IFTF, so we don't have to repeat it every single time. But I was reading a little bit about it, and it seems that one of the things that you do, or the team at the IFTF does, is they look at plausible stories about possible futures that are distinctly different from the present and that provide useful thinking about a current course of action for an individual, for an organization, or even for a state or nation. Is that kind of the mission in a nutshell of the IFTF?
I think that's a fair assessment, Brent. The one thing that the Institute does not do and is careful to shy away from is attempting to predict anything, because the reality is the future is not knowable. That's what makes it interesting, actually. So any attempts to make predictions about anything in the future is almost always destined to be wrong. So if you can't make predictions, what you can do is you can make forecasts or create scenarios which are plausible and internally consistent stories about a possible future that is different than today. And you can put bounds on the limits of what is likely to happen, and you can give people a set of stories or contexts that they can use to test strategies for moving forward for their own organizations.
Okay, and although you try kind of stay away from the word prediction, what has impressed you that the IFTF has identified as a future trend and, in effect, were successful in identifying that trend and, in effect, predicting the future, even if it was in hindsight?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite sayings has been attributed to both, I think, Peter Drucker and Alan Kay, who's the father of the personal computer. But whoever said it, I think it's a statement, is that the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And the Institute actually has done some inventing that really has been very foresightful and very influential. One of the earliest threads that go back to the days when I joined them, actually back even before that in the late 1970s and early 80s, was that there were people at the Institute who were looking at computers. And remember, this is well before the rise of personal computers and when computers were still kind of big data crunching machines. But the Institute was interested in looking at these things as communications devices. And they were exploring, under a series of grants from the National Science Foundation, what they called computer-mediated communication. And the idea is things like email, like discussion groups, forums, even chat. The Institute actually built some of the very earliest and now very primitive-looking systems, and then would deploy them in pilots in organizations and do studies to see how that would affect people's behavior. And, what we all spend probably a couple of hours a day now doing and don't even think about. It's just, email and being on a chat line or a forum is just sort of part of everyday life. But it really began as a very pioneering effort at the Institute.
And I need to underscore the fact that if we're talking about a time frame of the late 1970s, we didn't even know that there was going to be a personal computer, at least most of us didn't. And then the ability for those computers to be networked and those networks to be worldwide. I mean, these were all things that just were not on the map. So to understand that this was a possibility took a unique thinking style that obviously the IFTF has cultivated. You also like to quote William Gibson in some of the things that I've written that you've read that you've written, Richard. And that quote is, "The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed." Now, what does that mean?
Yeah, that actually is a terrifically important observation that underlies a lot of the methodology that the Institute uses for thinking about the future. And one of the ways, so you're being asked to talk about the future of healthcare or the future of transportation or the future of cities or the future of food. or the future of education, all of which are projects that the Institute has been involved with in the last couple of years, or the future of the boomers. So how do you do this? Well, one method that has been very fruitful for the Institute is what we describe as a process of signals, of identifying signals, and it's looking for events or trends or developments in the environment that may be something quite small or a little bit out of the ordinary, but that is that seems as if it might be an indicator of a change in the environment. And so what one can do, and actually the Internet is a marvelous tool now because it lets you scan practically all the information in the universe, whereas, you know, literally in the old days you had to get newspapers and magazines and clip out articles and paste them together and pass them around. Now, of course, a lot of that can be automated. But as you find these signals within a domain, let's say the future of the boomers, so you start searching for what are the boomers up to or what are people saying about the boomers' activities, and then you collect these signals and create a little database of them. And then after a period of weeks or months, you and often this can be done by a group of people who share this process of signal capture, then you can sort of lay them all out and start looking for patterns in them. And what often happens is out of those will emerge some very striking ideas of three or four or five what might initially seem as unconnected sets of activities that suddenly form a pattern, kind of like, you know, what the intelligence community talks about when they talk about connecting the dots. Uh-huh. So you collect a lot of the dots. It is a kind of an intelligence process where you're trying to anticipate future events, not necessarily in a dire or in a violent environment, but in a positive environment.
Well, and of course, this begs the question, then, what exists currently that isn't necessarily as evenly distributed and is more likely to be distributed to become tomorrow's norms for adults who are moving past 50 and 60? That's a lot to chew on. But yes.
Yeah, I'll give you one example that I've been interested in for a couple of years, and I've written several reports on, and that is an area that when I first started looking at it, I called mobile health. And now has become fairly popular. Now it's just being called mHealth. And the idea is that there are millions, and now maybe I think a billion, people on this planet who now, on an everyday basis, carry around a device with them that is connected, that is portable, that is personalized, and increasingly intelligent. And what I'm talking about is a mobile phone, and particularly the smartphones, which, you know, are actually little computers, but they're little connected, always-on, personalized devices that people are carrying around. And one of the many things one can do with it, is to use it as a platform to both monitor an individual's health and also to deliver at appropriate moments health-related information. And so, you know, the scenario that I started developing a couple of years ago and now is actually sort of a worldwide phenomenon is you know, what I call the doctor in your pocket. So that, you know, medical care might at some future point not be seen as something that you have to go and get by making an appointment with a doctor at a clinic, but, you know, could be dialed up instantaneously on your mobile phone. In fact, it might even, if it's smart enough and connected enough, it might be monitoring your health. And if something goes out of whack in your system, if you're a diabetic and your insulin level spikes or your glucose level spikes or your heart has an unusual pattern and it's being followed, you know, it could flag you and let you know, hey, you better go in and get this looked at. And I suspect in an aging system, to connect this to the boomers, in an aging society in which the dominant preoccupation of the healthcare system isn't so much going to be acute illnesses where somebody gets sick goes in, gets treatment, and then goes home, but rather chronic conditions, diabetes, arthritis, hypertension, obstructive pulmonary disease, that people will live with for years and years and years, and in fact where the individual, the patient themselves, has to act as the primary caregiver. This technology, I believe, may be the thing that will be a critical component in supporting people's ongoing lives so that they live with and manage these chronic conditions well.
Well, that I'd like to connect to a couple of other things that I'm thinking about, Richard, that kind of impinges on this new technology, mHealth. One is, I may be not completely accurate in my statistics, but I'll be close enough. There are about 23,000 medical doctors in the United States focused on children and taking care of children, yet there are only 7,000 geriatricians in the United States, which means we're going to have a shortage of doctors that specialize in illnesses related to adults and aging. So perhaps this mHealth platform will be one way to address that shortage of geriatricians so that many people's health can be monitored in a central kind of command area, if you will, occupied by many less doctors than one-to-one traditional patient health care. Would you agree that that's a good possibility?
Well, the reality is that doctors, physicians, are a relatively scarce and extremely expensive resource. And going to see a doctor is a costly proposition. In fact, it's so costly that as society ages, you know, we already know that Medicare is well on the way to going bankrupt. And in fact, the current, I actually believe that the current healthcare system, the way it's evolved through the 20th century, just is not going to scale. You can't just take the current system and scale it up to deal with an elderly population that's double the size of the one that we have today, for example. It's going to have to be transformed fairly radically. And I think what I'm talking about with mHealth, that's one small potential part of a solution.
Right. Another trend that is being observed, that what the boomers are doing a little different than their own parents' generation, is a lot of people are moving to areas that are not necessarily dominated by state-of-the-art health care facilities, such as you find in major cities. There's a movement of a reasonable segment of boomers to rural environments, and so this mHealth, particularly for those with chronic conditions like diabetes or an ailing heart, provides a solution where they can live away from a major metropolitan area, but a little more securely than they could have, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah, you're actually connecting two really important trends. One is the aging of the population, and the other is sort of the needs of rural America. And both of those are ones that can be served not just by mHealth, but sort of the bigger category is what is known as telemedicine. It's sort of the ability to deliver remotely healthcare, and the area that I think you're pointing to is probably the most critical one, is that, you know, most people can get access to a primary care physician, an internist, a family doctor. The place where it really gets tough is when you need a specialist. And those are the people who tend not, you know, they tend to be in the major metropolitan areas, they tend to be at medical centers, and they don't tend to be out in the countryside. And if access to the specialist could be provided remotely, you know, that would be a tremendous boon to helping to solve this problem, again, of the mismatch of resources and needs.
Well, so far we've talked about Richard's journey into the past, I guess you could say, when he started with the Aspen Institute, and then, of course, his involvement with the Institute for the Future, where we started looking at the possibilities of thinking back then as it translates to what we're confronting today, opportunistically speaking, as well as possibilities in the immediate future. I'd like to transition into our next part of our program today, which is going to take a look at the next 20 years for the boomers, which is incidentally a study that Richard was involved in, as I mentioned earlier. And we're going to talk about that in some depth. So stick around. We'll be back in just a moment.
Be sure to join us at fmguniversity.com. That's where we can turn your passion into business within 30 days. Put some fun back into your life, show you how to make money, and do good for yourself and others. That's why we are called FMG, Fun Money Good. Get started today. Go to fmguniversity.com.
I received a call from Richard Adler a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, and he offered to bring me to Washington, D.C. With a group of other people so we could sit around and talk about the future. It was actually a workshop, a very carefully guided workshop that took these individuals from many different points of view and started converging our thinking about what the future might hold for baby boomers 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And that was the foundation of a fairly comprehensive study. Richard, can you describe a little more in detail what the study entailed?
Yeah, it actually came about about 7 years ago. We were coming up to the point when the first boomers were just about to turn 60. Now, this year, in January of 2011, the first boomers turned 65, but this was 5 years before that when the first boomers were turning 60. And I was noticing a spate of news stories in magazines and newspapers across the country with headlines like, "Boomers turn 60," as if this were surprising and amazing news. As if this weren't something that couldn't have been predicted 20 or... And this is something you actually can predict. I mean, if somebody is 50 today with... you know, pretty good confidence, you can predict in 10 years if they're still alive, by golly, they're going to be 60. So, you know, demographics are the one, are probably the thing that you can predict with the most confidence. So, you know, here what was becoming clear is that the boomers were about to reach a, you know, having gone through childhood and transformed that stage of life, and then teenagehood, which they really almost kind of invented the whole notion of teenagers, then into early adulthood and then midlife, and now they were on the brink of later life. And as I said earlier, my sense was that as this huge portion of the population, some 71 million Americans, began to move into their 60s and 70s and 80s, it was going to be an unprecedented experience for America, and that it was very likely that this large and pretty distinct portion of our population was going to transform later life just as they had every other stage of life, but that nobody was looking at it. And so, at least in a deep and serious way. So I came up with an idea for a project which we called Baby Boomers, the Next 20 Years, and I actually realized this was going to be a pretty big project, and even though I was no longer on the staff of the Institute for the Future, I took it back to my friends there and said, would they be interested in doing this study with me? And in fact, we did. It was housed at the Institute for the Future. I was one of three co-leaders of the project there, along with two staff members, Rod Falcon and Kathy Vian. And we spent the next year and a half looking in a systematic way at what we thought was very likely to be the big stories about the boomers as they moved into later life.
Well, actually, we're going to talk about some of the big stories, of which there are seven. The big stories are uber themes, I guess is one way to describe them, that not only will affect boomers, but will affect probably every other generation, younger and older in some way, but the boomers are certainly going to fall into these big stories as they already are, because it's prime time for them in terms of their activities. So let's talk a little about, we're not going to be able to go into depth about each of the seven stories, but I looked at about four of them, if we have time, that I would like to talk about in a little more detail. Beginning with extended capacity, let me give a quote from the study. As the cohort that invented Forever Young, boomers will fight to extend their capacity to work, play, invent, create, teach, lead, and indulge themselves longer into life. Can you elaborate on that some, Richard?
Yeah, sure. You know, the forever young is probably the key to that. One of the interesting tensions that we saw that kind of fed into the story was, on the one hand, the inevitable impact of aging, and on the other hand, the boomers' strong commitment to staying active and engaged and vital. And in fact, for many reasons, psychological, pharmacological, and economic, it is very likely that that the boomers are going to attempt to stay, continue to work, to continue to play, to continue to travel, to continue to learn, well beyond the normal sort of expectations about how one's supposed to be acting when they reach later life. And by the way, this was initially the seven stories that you're referring to were kind of laid out on a very high level on what we called a map, which is a sort of a graphic representation of all these stories. And I believe it's on the web, and I can provide a URL where people can go look at this. But we later did in-depth interviews with about 50 boomers all across the country. And we found, examples of people who just were determined to what we called power through, to continue to quest, to develop, to stay involved, to keep winning races, to keep earning money, and rather than gracefully move into any sort of traditional sense of retirement.
I think my friend Jim, that I described at the top of the program, who was very successful as a CBS affiliate general manager and vice president, who was also on the CBS National Board of Advisors. So, theoretically, he could easily retire. Not Jim. He's re-educated himself as a hypnotherapist because he really, really likes at his core to help people. That's a driver that maybe wasn't fully addressed when he was younger. So in a sense, he's extending his capacity by learning an entirely different career and providing an entirely different set of services to his peers. Would that be a good example of an extended capacity?
Yeah, it's a great example. It also fits into a notion of sort of reinventing the self that we talked about some of our later boomer studies, because one of the realities of life that I think boomers are going to be confronting in the near future is the realities of ageism in the society. The fact that even though people may be, the boomer generation may be wanting to change all the definitions of what it means to be 60 or 70, these notions of what it's like to be older and a kind of a disregard and for people in older life is deep in the society and and forms a tension. And one of the industries in which ageism, unfortunately, is I think most deeply rooted is broadcasting. It's very tough to continue to function in that medium as you get older. And so it's interesting, your examples are people who were initially successful in broadcasting but then reinvented themselves in a different field.
Well, if the truth be known, Richard, I didn't bring this out, that Jim had a very stellar career of over 20 years, but then his station was purchased by another group and they, in effect, cleaned house, even though he had done a phenomenal job of building the network revenue and extending the network into his community. So, he made a couple of stabs at seeing if there'd be another opportunity as a general manager of a major affiliate. And, the opportunities weren't coming to his front door. So he extended his capacity primarily because he wanted to continue working. He was able to address some deeper internal needs that perhaps were never really addressed in his role with the TV station. But he also had to do this to keep himself busy, to feel like he was engaged in having some kind of a meaningful impact on the world around him. So moving on, you also describe another big story as new sociability, which means, in effect, this generation has cultivated a long-standing romance with the ideal of collective action. I see a lot of implications for that, but what are your thoughts about the new sociability?
Well, it's interesting. When we did this work just a few years ago, that idea was still somewhat novel, and I think with the rise of social media, it's becoming almost commonplace. Again, sometimes the future arrives so quickly. I mean, one of the ways I'm often surprised is we'll make a prediction for some, or a forecast for something that, you know, we expect will happen 5 or 10 or 15 years out, and you turn around and it's already here. And I think this is a great example where the internet, which started out as first of all a communications and an information access medium, you know, the giant story over the last couple of years has been the rise of Facebook and Twitter and the social media that really have changed or offered a lot of, you know, wholly new ways for people to present themselves, to connect with other people. And again, in a very short period of time, you know, just take Facebook, for example, went from being something which was for college kids to something that I think the statistic I heard the other day is something like 70% of all adult Americans now have a Facebook page, and that something like one-third of all Facebook members are over the age of 45.
We've definitely seen research to the effect that the fastest growing market, at least last year on Facebook, was the baby boomer women. And
I think particularly, I mean, one of the things I've discovered, I think many people value the internet for the fact that it's a great way to find and reconnect with sort of people that were meaningful to you earlier in your life and then you've lost track of, and you can now friend them on Facebook and sort of follow in an easy way kind of what their lives are like. And so it's a lovely way to reconnect.
And, you know, one of the things that I've observed, Richard, is that it's somewhat unique to the late silent generation and the baby boomers that, you know, we grew up at a time where we might graduate from college and a good friend or college roommate from that time would disappear. And I mean, you'd have to hire a private eye sometimes to find an individual, even if you wanted to. So you'd basically let those relationships go and assume that they would never reoccur. 40 years goes by, something like Facebook appears, Twitter appears, other forms of online search such as Google, and now you can connect with people that you may have lost touch with for 20, 30, 40 years. No younger generation is going to experience that. That will not happen from now on into the future. Would you agree? This is a unique, call it a discontinuity.
Yeah. In fact, you may not be able to lose touch with people whether you want to or not. You know,
correct. Sort
of your entire cohort of acquaintances from your whole life may now accompany you.
Yes.
One important observation. I was actually at a workshop last night at the Institute for the Future, and it was a group of teachers who were looking at the use of digital media in the classroom. It was very interesting because these were junior high school, high school teachers from public schools, and there were a number of projects that were being discussed on bringing particularly video, low-cost, easy-to-use video into the classroom as a way of raising consciousness about things like social justice. And the director of the current executive director of the Institute, a woman named Marina Gorbis, made a comment that I thought was really important. And she says, you know, with every new technology, with every new medium, we gain something, we get new capabilities, but probably we also lose something. We may lose a kind of an intimacy. We may lose a sense of individual privateness, which now is eroded by these technologies. And I think that's really a great point, that, you know, it's a mistake to just celebrate these technologies in a kind of totally uncritical way, and it's also a mistake to bash them as terrible things, because they all bring trade-offs.
I think that's a very excellent point, and sometimes we forget that, you know, in the never-ending quest for the new and the novel, we sometimes forget possibly some of the things we lose as we move into the new and novel. And I think certainly a lot of our listeners and boomers in general have experienced that on one level or another as this move toward technology and networking and so forth has continued to dominate their lives in a greater and greater capacity. Where normally when this program involves usually the fourth part, the last 15 minutes, a discussion about the future, which is obviously what we've been doing the entire show today. So what we're going to do is come back and we're going to continue our discussion about the seven big stories governing the boomer future. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is have fun, make money, do good. We provide platforms to individuals who have a cause, message, or information that they would like to share with the world. If you'd like to join the FMG family and have your own radio show, please call us at 1-800-470-4982. That's 1-800-470-4982. We look forward to hearing from you.
I'm delighted today to have Richard Adler with us, who obviously has been very much in the conversation of what is the future going to look like for, you know, a bit over maybe 40 years. But he's actively involved in it today. He has a futurist perspective, and out of that perspective has come this important study called Boomers, the Next 20 Years. And we were talking about some of the big stories that are impacting the boomers as they age. We just finished talking about the new sociability. Richard, there's also one that you've described called the wealth generation, which I'll quote, perhaps the greatest challenge ahead is still ahead of them, and to generate new forms of wealth that will bridge the gap between their savings and failing institutional safety nets. You've touched on that a bit, but I wondered if you could go ahead and elaborate some more about this wealth generation concept.
Yeah, well, I think when we identified that story at the time, we knew it was important. And then I think in the wake of the financial meltdown, which decimated the finances of millions of Americans and particularly hits hard on older workers who may have lost a job and may never go back to work at the same level, whose wealth in their homes has been significantly impacted. This question of wealth generation is even more critical than it was. And I think what we were particularly focusing on is what we called new forms of wealth. And what we were really thinking about was beyond, the notion is if you have a job, you lose your job, and you want to get another job. Well, it may be you may never get another job, or certainly for people who've worked in large corporations as you get older. Like your friends who you started talking about at the beginning of the program, who've reinvented themselves in new ways and found other skills that they care about, that's, a great paradigm, I think, for what we are talking about. Mark Friedman of Civic Ventures talks about what he calls encore careers, which is people who have had careers often in a business environment, and then they leave that and they decide they want a different kind of career, still working, still generating income, but one in, say, a public sector job or a public service job where not only are they doing this, or they may be doing it not primarily for the money, although the money counts, but because of the meaning of the work that they're doing, working with kids, working with elders. And even beyond that, I think that we need to look not only for resources in terms of financial capital, but in terms of things like social capital, which is the relationships that people have with one another, the ability of people to help out. To go back to an earlier topic, we were talking about a crisis in healthcare, and my sense is that the current healthcare system that is doctor-centric and based around, high-tech medical centers just simply, first of all, isn't economically sustainable, but also isn't going to be appropriate for the health needs of people in the future. And it can. And my sense is that there's lots of ways in which lay people can help one another. There's some marvelous experiments with what's been called patient self-education, groups of peers getting together to share their own experiences around managing chronic illnesses that turns out to be as effective or more effective in some ways than high-cost medical care. So that, you know, we may find sources of wealth not just in the sort of traditional forms of employment or savings, but in the ways in which we can help one another through voluntary efforts and interpersonal connections.
And, you know, that connects really with some of the sociological underpinnings of the boomer generation, which has always been a self-directed generation. In other words, self-help really exploded in the boomers' youth coming out of places like the Esalen Institute, the Human Potential Movement. And today we find it manifested in things like self-directed medical care, which you were just describing. In other words, if I've got a certain chronic condition, I'm going to become the master of my own disease, if you will, and learn everything about it and question everything and look at all the resources and all the medications and all the possibilities. And obviously, we can see that extending that into the future, that same attitude as people grow older and get more chronic medical problems.
Yeah, and I certainly think self-directed care, taking responsibility for one's own health, is important. But I also think it's true is that you can be sick alone, but to be well, you need a community. And so there's right. That interesting tension between that desire for independence and that impulse toward communal connection that I think is one of those themes that has run through the boomers' lives from the beginning.
That's a fabulous insight, Richard. I fully agree. It's a great connect the dot right there. I think we have time to talk briefly about one more of the seven big stories, and that's global transparency. Again, I quote from the study, as global trade and connectivity continue to grow, they will look, meaning the boomers will look, beyond their own borders for solutions to the problems of growing older. So what are you seeing as a discontinuity in that area that will become more likely to be mainstream as we go forward?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It's interesting. All the other six stories are ones that I think you can see playing out kind of in today, in the world of the present. That's the one, the global transparency is probably the one that I think is still off a little bit in the future. But, you know, in the Tom Friedman sense of the world is flat and that we're all connected together. Again, a statistic that really struck me that I was hearing some discussions of the one-year anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, and something like 60% of all Americans made a contribution to help Haiti. I mean, that's an amazing statistic. I suspect I can't think of any other event. I mean, first of all, that 60% would contribute to something not in our country, something somewhere else. And the reason that I think people were moved to do that is because the story was brought into their own homes day by day by, you know, very effective coverage on the media. But, you know, there's going to be all kinds of ways in which the world is getting smaller and smaller and more interconnected. I mean, again, to go back to my theme of healthcare, you know, when you need your customer service, you often place a phone call and find yourself talking to somebody in India. You know, there's no reason why, and in fact, I think this already exists today. If you break an arm and you get an X-ray, there's no reason that the radiologist who reads that X-ray has to be in the United States. That X-ray radiologist could well be in India and charge one-tenth what a radiologist would in the U.S. Really, the only barrier to it is licensing and regulation. The technology, it's perfectly possible today.
Right, and the way that I think about that has fascinated me is the growth of medical tourism. And I think, you know, from my own point of view, that's a discontinuity, if you will. It became a shocking, disruptive continuity. You know, we attended a conference together with hosted by Skip Brickley, who has taken a very serious look at the future of medical tourism and the idea that U.S. boomers may go overseas to substantially reduce the cost for treatment of a medical condition such as a hip replacement is not too far off, where that may become a lot more popular and mainstream than it is today. Are you somewhat in agreement with that?
Well, let me share with you one of my real ahas from the last year or two. and that is that I, as I've done this work now for decades, that I think I had for many, many years a kind of deep and unconscious assumption that there were many interesting places in the world. There were places that were exotic and attractive and fun to visit and, you know, had their own kind of interesting cultures that were exotic. But if you were talking about innovation, man, that happened here in the good old U.S. of A. And particularly since I've lived for the last several decades in Silicon Valley, you know, this was the very heart of innovation right here in the Silicon Valley. And, you know, it all radiated out from here and then trickled down to the rest of the world. Well, I no longer believe that. I now believe that innovation is something that happens all over the world. It happens in the first world, the second world, and the third world, that people have figured out that education is the path to success and that innovation is the way we get out of our problems. And in many areas, again, go back to mHealth, when I did that original study and I started looking at where was the innovations in mHealth, it turned out that the great majority of the most interesting mHealth applications were not being developed in the U.S., but they were being developed in places like India and Singapore and China. And so now I think, you know, if we really want to flourish, we can't just think about innovation as something that is a U.S. export, but it has to be something that we are sensitive to across the globe.
Well, those are outstanding concluding comments, Richard. As I promised you when we talked about this program offline, that an hour would not be enough, and certainly it is not.
But you mean the hour is up?
Yeah, we've reached the end of our time. But I want to thank. Yes, but I want to thank you for spending the time with us today and helping us get a little clearer view of the future of aging, business, and certainly how our lives will be dramatically changed based on the discontinuities that we've been discussing today. If you want to find out more about Richard's work, I would invite you to go to the Institute for the Future's website. That's www.iftf.org. Or you can go to the Aspen Institute. That's www.aspeninst.org. So again, Richard, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Brent, it's been a pleasure.
Hopefully we'll have other opportunities to have you back. I would certainly like to leave the door open, and I hope we can get you back because obviously this is a fascinating area that deserves many more conversations. Next time, our guest will be another futurist, Thomas Fry, PhD. He is the executive director and senior futurist at the Da Vinci Institute, a futurist think tank based near Boulder, Colorado. Because of his work inspiring inventors and other revolutionary thinkers, the Boulder Daily Camera has referred to him as the father of invention. The Denver Post and the Seattle Post-Intelliger have referred to him as the Dean of Futurists. He is the top-rated future speaker in Google. Before starting the Da Vinci Institute, Tom spent 15 years as an IBM engineer and designer, where he received over 270 awards and patents, more than any other IBM engineer in history. He is also a past member of the 999 Society. What's that? That is the elite group of people whose IQ is in the 99.9 percentile. So we're going to continue our discussion with the future. I want to thank you, our listeners, for being a part of the future we want to reinvent. I want to thank you for being part of Generation Reinvention.
You've been listening to Generation Reinvention with your host, Brent Green. Visit Brent at his website at generationreinvention.com. And for archive shows, be sure to visit his show page here on the FMG Radio Network, where our motto is, have fun, make money.